For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Taigen's teachings, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening.
Good evening.
So we're very honored to have with us tonight Dagakurume, who is going to speak for us.
Thank you, Taigen.
Spent some 27 years in practicing at Hoshinji, one of the major training temples in Soto Zen in Japan, and now lives at the San Francisco Zen Center and works for the Japanese Soto School International Center in San Francisco. Welcome, Daigaku.
Thank you, Taigen. Good evening. It's a great pleasure to be at Ancient Dragon this evening. I thank you for coming out on a Monday night. One part of my job is to travel and visit Zen centers around North America, and I don't think I've been to one as new, smelling, and fresh as Ancient Dragon. It's a pleasure to see what you're doing here, and I congratulate you on what you're doing. Tonight I'd like to talk about one of the best known Zen stories from China, Everyday Mind is the Way. And I suppose many of you have heard this story before. I've heard the story hundreds of times, but if you have heard it before, imagine that you're hearing it for the first time. That's my request to you. But by way of introduction, I'd like to say that in Japan, there are two major schools of Zen, Rinzai and Soto. And Dogen Zenji, the great Japanese priest who we think of as the founder of Soto Zen in Japan, he lived about 800 years ago. Perhaps his best known teaching is to study the way of Buddha is to study the self. I'm sure virtually all of you are familiar with this, right? So if you want to know what an awakened, liberated human being is, Dogen says, study the self. He doesn't say, study the sutras and so on and so on. He says, study the self, right? And then he continues, to study the self is to forget the self. And I often think the question could arise, how can you study the self if you forget it? Or we could turn it around and say, how can you forget the self if you're studying it? And I don't know if you've ever had that question. Maybe yes, maybe no. But I use it as one example of a question that could arise when we come in contact with the Zen teaching or the Buddhist teaching. I mean, there could be any number of other questions. Why is sitting facing the wall the practice of a Buddha, for example? Or what do you mean that thinking of not thinking is non-thinking? And so on, any number of questions. And the reason I bring this up is we have a very important way of coming into the practice. Listening, thinking, practicing. I don't know if you're familiar with this. Perhaps Taigen has spoken to you about this. But it's an important way we come to understand the principles of the practice. And I believe it's necessary to understand what we're doing as part of the practice. So in other words, somehow or other, we come in contact with the Buddhist teaching, the Zen teaching. And probably the main two ways would either be hearing someone speak about it or reading about it. But it's very unlikely that when we first come in contact with the teaching that we understand it completely from the beginning. Studying the self is forgetting the self. And then, for example, it's great to have contact with a teacher, someone that you can ask these questions in person. And you're very fortunate to have Taigen Leighton here in Chicago, someone that you can ask these questions. Right? But even if you got a good answer from Taigen, it's very likely that that would simply be the seed for more questions. So this is something that's ongoing. It's going to take a while. But I'd like to emphasize this matter of really thinking about the answer. And then if further questions arise, taking them back to Taigen. and asking and thinking. And then when we more or less have a handle on the principles of the practice, we can really dive into it. And we won't worry if we're going to hit our head on something. Or how long is it going to take? Or am I really doing it correctly? And maybe most importantly, what's going to happen as a result of practice? We won't worry about those questions. So what I'd like to do tonight is, as I mentioned, speak about the story from China, Everyday Minds is the Way. I'm only going to speak for about 30 minutes, not too long. I'd like to leave some time at the end for questions. So I encourage you to ask questions about anything I say or don't say. If you have questions about practice in Japan or Zen Center or whatever, please feel free to ask. Quite often, one person's question is somebody else's question. So you may be doing somebody else a favor by asking a question. And if I don't know, we'll get Taigen to answer. And if he doesn't know, we'll do our best to find out for you. Okay? So this story, Everyday Mind is a Way, I often think here in America, people might wonder, why talk about stories from China? Why not talk about American stories? In my case, there's two good reasons. First of all, I practiced for a rather longer time in Japan, and these are the old stories that are still brought out to speak about practice and the Dharma. So these are the stories I'm most familiar with. And by the way, I'm most familiar with the pronunciations of these people's names in Japanese. No big thing, I think. And secondly, I don't know any good American stories. It could very well be that there are good American stories, I just don't know them. But I do know for sure that if stories like this do not appear in America, that the Dharma will not really take root in this country. But one of the great things of these Chinese stories is that if you put yourself in the shoes of the person asking the questions, then this story will come to life for you. So I invite you to do that. And there are two people in this story, Joshu, the student, and Nansen, the master. And Joshu has a question. He's been thinking. And his question is, what is the way? It's very similar to this quote for this teaching from Dogen. What is the way of Buddha? And I believe we can think of this in various ways. What is the Dharma? Or what is Zen? Or what is the self? Or what is freedom, liberation, peace of mind, true satisfaction? If you've ever had a question like one of those, imagine that you're asking Nansen, the master, this question. So Joshu asked the master, what is the way? And Nansen said, title of the story, Everyday Mind is the Way. Or sometimes translated as Ordinary Mind is the Way. In other words, from the time we get up in the morning till the time we go to bed at night, it's all the way. However you live your life, turning off the alarm clock if you need one, getting out of bed, using the toilet, taking a shower, brushing your teeth, and all of those things, breakfast, getting ready to go to work, driving to work or taking the L to work and so on, and all of the pleasant and unpleasant things during the day. It's all the way. So in other words, Nansen has said, don't look for the way outside of your everyday life and mind. I often think that if we read these stories in a book, it may seem like the next question was right there. But imagine that he was thinking about that for 5 minutes or so anyway, or he may have been thinking about that for several months. But I'd like to point out two things. One is that for Nansen, the master, it is said that it took him about 30 years of hardship and suffering and groping in the dark for him to be able to make that teaching his own. So that's obviously very different than reading about it right? Or hearing someone like me talk about it. That means really making that your own. And that took him a long time. Even though now this is one of the most familiar Zen expressions, you'll often see it on a calligraphy. Hei Jo Shin Zedo. And secondly, it's very easy, I think, if we hear a story like this, to think, oh yeah, of course. From the time I get up in the morning to the time I go to bed at night, it's all the way, of course. But that's not what Nansen is saying. Because he's talking about something that cannot be perceived. And this is one of the biggest mistakes or pitfalls in Zen, to read a teaching or hear the teaching and think, sure, it's all the way. People might even start thinking, well, why sit Zazen then? Why practice? If it's all the way, there's no need to practice. We even have a term for this, Bujizen. So imagine that Joshu has been thinking about this question for a little while there. Everyday mind is the way. We could imagine that he might have thought, well, if everyday mind is the way, why don't I know that? Why did I have that question in the first place? Or he might have been thinking, if everyday mind is the way, including pleasant and unpleasant things, that would mean that greed, anger, and ignorance is also the way. How can that be? So he was compelled at that point to ask another question. He didn't let it just go at, oh, okay, everyday mind is the way, uh-huh. And that was the end of it. He was compelled to ask another question. And that question was, how can I find it? And the master Nansen said a very famous answer. If you try and find the way, you'll just get further and further away from it. So it's as if you wanted to go east, but you're actually facing west, and the further you go, you're just getting further and further away from your destination. I was recently in New York City. I'm not used to being in Manhattan. And as you know, it's like Chicago. I had a little tour of Chicago today. Many big buildings, but even more, as you know, if you've been there, more packed together somehow. And I'm usually pretty good with directions, but I couldn't see the sun. I think that was the reason. But I had that experience of walking down Prince Street, looking for a certain subway station. But I kept going and going, and I didn't find it. Couldn't find it. And I realized at a certain point, I was walking in the wrong direction. I don't know if you've ever had that. It's kind of a strange experience. You know you're on the right street. You see the street sign there, but you can't find it. Of course, in Chicago, if you walk far enough, you'll come to another subway station. But I didn't know that, so I had to turn around and head back. But Nansen is saying the same thing. If we have a bunch of books about Zen at home, one shelf, two shelf, maybe three shelves of books, and we have an idea of what the way is, a conceptual idea of the way, and we start looking for it, we're just going to get further and further away from that, what we're looking for. We're right in the middle of it already. It's like Hawking's famous man in the water, shouting out in thirst. We're looking for the way and we're right in the middle of it. Joshu later became one of the all-time great Zen masters. You can find a book called The Record of Joshu. Hundreds of his sayings and stories and so on, including this one. Maybe he was in the top 10. I'm being a little bit facetious, but he's one of the all-time great. In fact, Dogen was... had a lot of respect and admiration for Joshu. But I often think, and I'm speaking very personally here, that in the Soto sect, we don't emphasize enough the fact that in this story, he didn't have a clue. He was the one asking the questions, not giving the answers. So that means there was a time when he didn't know what the way was. And later on, there was a time when he did. And later on, he said, after he realized what the way was, he said, you know, before I realized what the way was, it was as if I was always used by time. You know that feeling of having too many things to do and not enough time to do them? I don't know if you've ever had that feeling, but I think a lot of modern people have that feeling. But after his realization, he said, that was like I had all the time in the world. He had achieved that freedom. Even though it's the same person, if he stubbed his toe, for example, that would still hurt. If he ate something spicy, that would be still spicy. And so if he touched something warm, it would be warm, and so on. But he had achieved this freedom. In other words, he had made the way his own. But in this story, no, he hadn't. He was probably a very frustrated young monk. He had the question. He was getting the answers. He was in contact with his Zen master. But it wasn't working out probably like he expected. My everyday life, it's the way. But if I try and find it, I'm just going to get further and further away from him. I often think he must have been very frustrated. But that's also an important part of Zen practice, what we call questioning mind. And I encourage you to think that questions are important in Zen practice, to keep that questioning mind. So he was compelled to ask another question. He didn't let it just go at that. He was compelled to ask another question. And that question was, if I don't do something, if I don't do some sort of practice, how am I ever going to make the way my own? And Nansen, the master, said, and this is really the most famous part, perhaps, of the story, the way is neither knowing nor not knowing. In other words, if you know what the way is, that's a delusion. Or if you know what Zen is, or the Dharma, or freedom, peace of mind, that's an illusion. On the other hand, if you say, well, it doesn't matter, in that case, I'm just going to forget about it, that also is not a solution. That's, he said, indifference. Or apathy. When you reach that place that is beyond doubt, how can you talk about it in terms of this and that and right and wrong and so on? You'll find it is as vast as space. And hearing those words, the answer of his master Nansen, Joshu, realized the way. That was the condition by which he realized the way. I hope you sense the importance of him following up on these questions. So at that instant, the way and Joshu disappeared. The way no longer existed. It was gone. Now, I don't suppose any of you have realized the way simply hearing me talk about it. I'm not that good of a storyteller or a Zen master. I'm not a Zen master, by the way. But how does this story relate to our Zen practice? I think that's the most important thing. That's what really brings us together. And really, when I speak, I usually come back to these questions. What is Zen practice, and why do we do it? Now, earlier I mentioned this teaching of Dogen Zenji. To study the self is to forget the self. And I'm sure there are different ways of interpreting this, but the way I understand this is that if we want to study the way of Buddha, the way of freedom, of awakening, Dogen is suggesting to study the self. And I think of that self with a capital S. Even though in the original both of these selves are the same word in Japanese, I think it may be easier for us to understand the first time around that study the big self. In other words, the self that is one with everything. And how do you do that? Dogen says, well, if you want to study the big self, then forget the small one. We sometimes call it the ego. And if you do, you will realize you will cast off body and mind and so on. The teaching continues and so on. In our everyday life, from the time we get up in the morning till the time we go to bed at night, our life is really a seamless stream. There isn't the slightest place where the self, me, can really enter in. In some real sense, it doesn't exist, except as an idea, although that is a big thing in itself. But as a certain object, it doesn't really exist. I don't think any of you stand in front of the mirror when you're brushing your teeth and say, I'm brushing my teeth, or I'm combing my hair, or I'm driving to work, or I'm getting angry at that person who just cut right in front of me. We don't do that. Those things happen automatically. There is simply that activity. And yet, we have come to think of this thing, commonly called the human body and mind, as me. We all do. And this is a problem. Because it's this identity of this thing as me that really creates that sense of separation in our life. And the bigger that separation, we say, the more hellish life is. And so I think of Zen practice, to a large extent, as an attempt, at any rate, to eliminate, or certainly to lessen, that sense of separation between me, which really doesn't exist, I would like to suggest. And any other activities, whether it's a person activity or so on, to be that activity, the thing itself. In fact, I'm fond of saying that there's nobody in this room who is listening to my voice. And what I mean by that is I don't think there's anybody here who's looking at me and saying, well, he's opening his mouth, it looks like he's saying something, I've got to try and figure out what he's saying. It doesn't work like that. It's automatic. Even if you don't understand what I'm saying, that's clear, you don't understand. Or if I were to begin speaking Japanese, for example, and you didn't speak Japanese, immediately you would know, I don't understand that. Sounds like he's speaking Japanese, or Chinese, or Korean. That happens automatically. And as you probably know, in Buddhism, we say there are six sense functions: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. We have five in the West, right? In Buddhism, we also have one more, that's thinking. And if we could leave these sense functions work automatically, that would be a Buddha. But we simply can't do it. And it's really the thinking aspect that trips us up the most. I think I'd like to leave you with one short poem. It's a Japanese poem, a four-line poem, kind of like a haiku, but with an extra short line there. It goes like this: this very moment. First line. Just think of only this. Second line. The past cannot return. The future cannot be known. That's it. Four lines. And I think this poem, I like this poem, I think it expresses what I think of as Zen practice. This very moment, that this idea of eliminating that sense of separation, whether we are sitting, standing, walking, or lying down, it doesn't matter. I don't think Zazen is restricted to any form of simply being that activity. The past cannot return. It's impossible for us to hold on to the past or change the past, even 5 minutes ago. Even though we often find ourselves dwelling on things that have happened in the past, perhaps wishing we could change them somehow, even though it's impossible to change them. Sometimes we even get obsessed about those things. Happens to me too. Or the future. It's impossible to know the future, right? Even 5 minutes from now. And we live our life pretty much expecting things might happen a certain way, even though we know, I believe, on a daily basis that things don't happen the way we would like them to. My teacher is fond of saying that things never happen the way we'd like them to, which always sounds really grim to me. Until I realized that everything is perfect in the moment now, if we could just accept it. The other part of that is that nobody can think of the moment now. Impossible. Even the Buddha. That is the way that cannot be known. The inconceivable. The unthinkable. And if you wonder about that, that means that anything that you perceive is already past. Even if it's a sound. So Zen, I believe, is really about making the moment now our own. And that means really, and this is not an easy thing, but really eliminating completely that sense of separation between me, good old me, and Zazen. I don't think I've been speaking that long, but I think I'll just let it go with that. Is that okay, Taigen? You know, we can. If you have any questions or comments are okay too. Some of you may disagree with what I say, or otherwise, if you have questions, feel free to bring them up. Thanks for listening. Please.
I got a little confused by what you were saying about, you know, to study the self, and you were talking about, you know, capital S, self, right?
Excuse me?
S, you were saying self. You were saying to study the self, and you were suggesting to think of it as S self.
The big self, you mean?
You were saying that in your talk, right?
Right.
So but it seems to me like when I'm sitting, studying the self, it really is, it's the small S self. In other words, it's my thoughts, my feelings, my feelings, you know, pain in the back, or my thoughts about the future, my memories, I mean, all that stuff. It's really what I find I'm just naturally studying, observing, is really small S self.
Right.
So I'm not real sure about how I would be studying this big...
I think that's a good point. Maybe I didn't explain that very well. One of the teachings I love in my lineage is that if you forget the self, then there's nothing that isn't the self. So I just present that to you first. Secondly, if you're familiar with the Heart Sutra, for example, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. It says quite clearly that there is no mind, no sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and so on. So you might wonder, well, then who is it? What's happening in those things that we think of as mine? And I think finally, the small self and the big self are the same. But the problem is this idea that I'm seeing, for example. And the way I understand no eyes, for example, in the Heart Sutra is, at that instant of seeing, there's only seeing. It's not me who's seeing. That's a thought that we put extra. And it's precisely because of that extra sense of me that we create that sense that I'm doing it. But nobody has to train themselves to see, right? If I put my hand out like that, you see it if you can see. And if I put it down, it's gone. But that's not something that you do. That happens automatically. It's not you who's seeing. That's simply that function. And I would like to suggest, and it would be a longer conversation, this is just an opening, you know, here, that sense of me is extra. and that if there is no sense of me, then everything is a self. That means everything we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and think, we are one with it. That is the self. So you might want to chew on that and then ask Taigen later about it. And if you have other questions, we can follow it up. But.
Well, so in other words, really, the small self and the big self are really not separate.
They're not really separate, but we think they are separate. And this is a problem. We think there's a self. Do you remember when you were born?
I can't remember.
No, I've never met anybody who could really, say honestly that they thought they could remember that. I would like to say that if this is really you, you should remember that. You should remember the beginning. But you don't. Nobody does. And you won't know that you're dead in the same way that you don't remember your birth. So the question is, when did you become me?
Thank you. I think this is another point that I've been thinking about in reading Essence of Zen. I had this idea, oftentimes when I read something about Zen, I'm struck by these cursory comparisons that one might make to other religious practices. Christianity, of course, is the one that I find around me most commonly. And I became interested in this idea of suffering. We hear a lot about suffering, and certainly Christian people have a role for suffering in their religious practice. And we're aware of Buddha suffering, and various of these historical figures all suffer, and yet, of course, they're all freeing themselves from suffering. I don't claim to speak for the Christians, but as I understand their paradigm, suffering is redemptive. And I'm interested in the idea of suffering and how it plays into Zen practice.
Mm-hmm. Suffering is part of life, and I think one of the big objectives of Buddhism is to bring an end to suffering. We all come in from a different, slightly different gate, angle, or so on, but I think quite often some form of suffering is what brings us to sit quietly looking at the wall. I mean, if you're gay all the time, that's probably the last thing you think about doing. So I think I personally believe in an end of suffering, that it is possible. I mean, you will hear Zen teachers say, well, it won't be as painful and so on. But I think the Buddha did bring an end to suffering. And the way he did that was he forgot the self. It's precisely that sense of me that is the cause. I mean, I would say the cause of suffering. It's not to say that birth, death, old age, and sickness and the other sufferings of life disappear. That's not the thing. But we no longer see them as something to avoid. In fact, we can avoid them. So why not just be one with them? Now, that's a lot easier to say, of course, than to actually carry out. So, I mean, it's one thing to think about it, read books about it. It's another thing through Zen practice to really do that. That's just an opening there. As I say, I like that idea as well, that the more separation we feel between ourselves and other people, whether it's at work and family or whatever we're doing, you know, our job and so on. I mean, it's with our job as well, that if we like our job, there's just less sense of separation. All the more happy for our lives and enjoyable, right? But if we're doing a job that we don't particularly like and we're just waiting to punch out, then of course we all know that feeling. That's just a little bit, or not a little bit, it's quite a bit more difficult. It's more suffering, right? So I think in Zen, it's really to let go of that dualistic, I like it or don't like it, regardless of whether we like that job or not. I mean, it's great if you're doing a job you do like, but sometimes we're doing things like cleaning the toilet and so on that we don't like to do. In Zen, it's really just to be there, to let go of that distinction of whether I like it or don't. Or even if it's there, it doesn't bother us. We can do it straight on. Please?
So you've practiced Zazen for many years. Could you talk about faith in Zazen?
Faith is extremely important. I think it's an extremely important part of Zazen that the Buddha did. I speak very personally that I believe the Buddha did bring it into suffering. That it's possible for me to do that. I think that faith is extremely important. But I would add that I don't think Zen is a religion of faith. Faith is important, but it's not the end. And in most religions, it is the end. If you have doubts, that means you don't have enough faith. But in Zen, we say the stronger your faith, the stronger your doubt. And doubt in Zen is equally as important as faith. You know, as Dogen said, you know, he realized, you know, everybody, it says in the sutras, everybody has Buddha nature. That's an article of faith for us. But why don't I know that? For Joshua, that was the question. And I believe we all have to have that a form of that question, or we're not really going, you know, there won't be a whole lot of power or direction in our practice.
I think the hardest thing for me is that I keep wanting to go back to Joshua. Well, what do I do to realize to practice
right.
Ordinary mind or everyday mind? You know, you'll be sitting there and you'll realize, oh man, I've been sitting here, I'm spaced out or really upset about something, angry. What do I do to come back? Mm. I guess in a way you've already done it, but somehow there's always this feeling that, okay, I've got to do something here, and then I guess you've sort of moved away from it again.
That's important. In this, what I just mentioned in this question here, faith, this was Hakuin's typology. Faith, doubt, and determination. The third aspect, determination. I'm going to do it. And it does mean returning. But it means at a certain point, you know, realizing that you can't just spin your wheels all the time. You know, just that, you know, there's the effort in some manner or form is also involved in it. And that also, you know, is something that we work with the teacher and so on. But don't give up.
When you talk of ending suffering, are you talking about for yourself or for everybody?
I think it's for everybody. That idea that one thing is everything and everything is one thing, if you can really do that for yourself, that means that everything is enlightened. The Buddha guaranteed that on his awakening, that everybody is endowed with the virtue and wisdom of the Tathagata. You know, he guaranteed it. That for us then is an article of faith. But I believe in that kind of awakening that yes, everything, it's not just little old me that gets awakened. You awaken with the whole. It's all one. So in some sense, you are bringing an end to suffering for everybody. They may not realize it, but in some sense, you know, we create our own problems. It's not anybody else. Well, I think there's tea and cookies, right? I don't want to...
May I ask another question?
Sure, of course, Titan, please. I don't know if I can answer your question.
The answers aren't important. Maybe you'll ask another question to me.
Right.
But questioning is important.
It is. I agree.
I agree with the way you're putting that our faith is a matter of questioning, of being open to questioning, not just taking it on faith, as sometimes said.
Blind
that.
Faith. It's not just blind faith.
Zazen is a question. Our life is a question. Our practice is a question. But I want to say something for the other side. How, in your sense of Zazen, where is letting go?
Mm-hmm. I think that, as I mentioned at the beginning, there are two sects of Zen, primarily. There's a smaller one called the Obaku, but primarily we have two different versions of Zen. And I think these are the schools that have, have stood the test of time. Originally there were five. Some people say seven. But Rinzai and Soto are really the two approaches. I think of them as two approaches to the same goal. Now, a lot of people don't think that, but that's how I see it. And I think both approaches we have to incorporate into our practice. Even if we happen to be associated, as we are, with Soto, there is an element of the questioning mind that is important. And I think it's often overlooked in Soto, this matter of the question. And so Shikan Taza, just sit. That, I believe, is not restricted to just a form, as I said earlier, as Dogen clearly says in Fukan Zazengi. It doesn't have anything to do with sitting or lying down. It's not restricted to the form. It could be behind the computer. It could be smoking a cigarette. So that is letting go. That's to be the thing itself. Not looking elsewhere, as Nansen says in the case, everyday mind. That's it, the thing itself. The question is also important, however, because if we perceive things as they are, that's a concept. That's not it either. So the question becomes, how can I make that my own? That, I believe, is also necessary. And that koan, that question, can take different forms. I believe both aspects are important.
Thank you. While we have Daigaku here, I also wanted to invite, if anyone has any questions, we're doing Zen in America, but Daigaku is one of the Americans who's really fully engaged in Japanese Zen, and of course they're not different and not separate and still. So wanted to offer you this opportunity to, if you have some inquiry or question about that. Dawn.
What do you do, how's the practice mainly in Japan? Because I've heard a lot that maybe it's more like funerals.
Well, I was in Japan 27 years. I think I was in two funerals during that time. So, I mean, it would vary from monastery to monastery. At the particular monastery where I was, there were other Westerners as well, not only myself. We were not involved in the... In Japanese, we have a word, dammu. That means the various ceremonies connected with the danka, the parishioners, if you wish, of the believers, the supporters of the temple. That was a function for the Japanese monks. They needed that in their role, as in their future role as a priest of a temple in Japan. So no, that was not a big part. No. No. Very little of that.
Mm-hmm. I guess I had a couple of questions about life in the temple. What would you do in between the summer and winter practice periods was one, and then the other is after practicing so long and becoming a senior monk, as you had more responsibilities for operating the temple, how did that change the amount of zazen you could do in your daily life?
So we had two practice periods every year. Fall, summer, fall, winter. Did I say that right? Spring, summer. Spring, summer, fall, winter. They were longer than 3 months. 3 months is the standard length of an anga, but ours were more like 4 months. So we had about a month. This doesn't quite calculate right, but there was about a month or a little bit more in between both of those. And generally speaking, we stayed at the monastery. We were allowed, at different times I was there, different amounts of time, but at the end it became about a week. We were able to leave the monastery for a week if we wanted to. Many people decided not to, if you can believe that. They just liked it so much there, they just... I was always eager to take my week off, but And I often did a little bit of takuhatsu, the begging, on my own, and visited friends or some other place, you know.
Club Med, maybe.
Pardon?
Club Med, you know.
Right. Well, I never made it that far, but I might have wanted, if I had enough money, I might have done that. But there are different arrangements. Some monasteries, they send all the monks away. But that quite often would mean that they would simply go back to their home temple and help out there and come back for the practice period. Yes, as staying there a longer time, I did have more responsibility. But one of the characteristics of my master was that he really felt that we were there for the zazen. So we didn't get involved in the administrative roles. I don't know if anybody even became Ino, or the administrator, the kanin, for example, the fusu. We would more likely end up in the kitchen, carpentry, taking care of the vegetable garden. And I did that for years, 20 years or more, in the vegetable garden, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Or taking care of guests and translation work. And so we always were able to sit sesshin, unless we were working in the kitchen, but that was also thought to be a kind of a sesshin practice in its own right. And I think the Roshi was looking out for us. He knew we were there for that practice, and he didn't let us get distracted from it. So we were fortunate, I think.
So with your height, you must have been a very imposing figure.
I was constantly hitting my head on
the clothes.
Did you have a question there?
Oh, actually, I have two questions that are totally unrelated. Well, related, but they're not. I was interested in what your typical day in zazen schedule is like, in terms of the rigor of it, and how much there was, how much walking, and how much sitting, and length of sitting. And then the other question is, I was interested in hearing about the relationship between the monastery and the surrounding community. Mm. In other words, to what extent is our, you know, normal Japanese involved in the life of the monastery or utilizing?
Right. We set one period of zazen. This is during the practice period. One period of zazen in the morning, about 40 minutes. They're 40-minute long period. And we're supposed to sit two in the evening, but usually only one. So not much zazen. A lot of work. And then we had six formal sesshin, sometimes seven a year. And that threw many Westerners who came, where's the zazen? You know, I came to do zazen. But we were really expected to channel that into zazen within movement, which simply means if you're sweeping the garden, sweep the garden. If you're cutting wood, just cutting wood. That is zazen. And that's a hard one for many Westerners to wrap their minds around. But that was the teaching. And then when we had sesshin, you know, we'd sit a lot.
How many days would those be?
There used to be 7-day sesshins. The basic schedule was quite easy. Get up at 4, go to bed at 9. But many people were sitting much more than that. As far as the relation with the community, very, very few people. I can count on one hand, perhaps. That may seem like an exaggeration. The number of local people who came to sit with us in 27 years. So that shows great reservation on the part of the community. But yet, the function of that monastery was to be a temple. It did service the Dongkra, their memorial services, funerals. There was a big cemetery which we took care of. That was one function of the temple. And it also functioned as a monastery. Those are two different things. Although it was one set of buildings. But for the local people, they felt this, and it was partly my master as well. He was just a little bit, he was more concentrated on the monastic part of it. Of course, he upheld his role as the head priest there. But he, you know, he was focused on the monastic part of it. And so they showed reservation. It wasn't that they couldn't come, but they didn't.
Bring gifts or anything. I mean, I know, like in the Southern, Southeast Asian tradition, there's a real sort of symbiotic relationship between I think in places like Thailand, but you're saying in Japan, at least in your experience, it's
First of all, remember this, I'm telling you of one experience, one place. There is definitely a symbiotic relationship. But, and the local people also had this reservation because it was a monastery. Very, very few monasteries in Japan. There are 15,000 Soto Shu temples, more or less, throughout the country. There are 25, more or less, monasteries. This happened to be one of them. They just had a certain reservation.
Okay. So, yes, Hoshinji, where Daigaku was, is training monastery, is not like a regular temple, so that in that sense it's different.
So you might see more of that in a temple.
Yeah, there would.
Oh, yeah.
That would largely depend also on the priest, you know, how outgoing he was. And some are very outgoing, some keep the doors locked. You know, there's a real, it's not, they're different.